Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks, the internet's leading all things Charles Band podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jared Hornbeck, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York, and I am pretty excited because we've got ourselves another bonus episode here. But, you know, I don't really do anything on the show by myself, so who is here for this bonus episode with me?
Well, hello, everybody. This is Steve Gunley coming to you from Austin, Texas. And yes, exactly. We are very excited to have a special guest joining us today for just kind of a special interview episode. Somebody with a IMDb that is absolutely staggering, covering a lot of movies that we are talking about on this show and then covering a lot of movies that we are obsessed with in our personal lives that don't come up on the show very often. So I'm excited that we're going to get to talk about all of this. Jared, who's joining us today?
I'm glad you asked, Steve. So the cool thing about these interview style episodes is that we've managed to get directors, we've managed to get actors, we've managed to get screenwriters. And for this one, it's a little bit different because we're taking it to, you know, an area of the movie crew that sometimes doesn't get as much love, but that we like to highlight and point out. And that's the people in like the makeup and effects department of movies. And so we've got a big one with us here, Jeff Farley, who is a longtime collaborator on many Empire and Full Moon movies and a ton of other movies, which we'll get to, is here to talk to us. And we're so excited to have you. Jeff, what's going on, man?
Hey guys, Jared, Steven. Very nice to finally meet. And you know, it's what can I say? It's been slow. Slow lately after the strikes and then nobody working. I mean, I don't think I did any film project since like early January, and then just subsisting off of whatever comes in, a painting commission or this or that. But from what I understand, things are popping over at Full Moon, which is good. But we're here to talk about a little bit about what I used to do with those guys and all the way back into the Empire days. I mean, even because that was it. I mean, I started watching Charlie Band movies back the theaters. I mean, maybe it might have been End of the World, might have been the first one I saw in the theaters. Because I remember I saw Laser Blast, but I did see End of the World in the theater and couldn't make heads nor tails of it. And I finally have watched it again. It makes a little more sense now these days. I mean, it's a really odd film, and no, I mean, even shot as low budget as it was, Boy, they put as much as they could into it, really. I mean, that's one thing I always liked about Charlie's films is they always had this real distinct style. And I thought maybe one day I'd actually work for the guy. So,
and that's cool that you were able to just kind of make that happen. I mean, yeah, it's really exciting to have you here because you have some behind the scenes perspective on a lot of films, just kind of running the entire gamut from high end like AAA productions to like B movies to independents to kind of everything. You've been working pretty steadily for a really long time. Like I said, your IMDb is insane. I counted there's 129 makeup effects credits and 115 special effects credits, ranging on just about everything. And I'm always fascinated, especially with people who get into this particular field. What was it that made you want to get into movie makeup, movie special effects? For most people, there was like one movie that really kind of tipped them over. Did you have one in particular that inspired you?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it goes all the way back to when I was a kid. I must have been 5 years old when, I mean, I think my brother got the old Aurora Frankenstein model kit. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, what is that? That's really neat. I mean, I knew nothing about monsters at the time. And my brother never got into the monster scene, but it was he who sort of, you know, he's the one who sort of maybe opened the door a little bit. And I remember the first one I think I got was the Godzilla, the old fuchsia and the long box, you know, fuchsia colored long box, you know, kit. And it was really cool, but I still hadn't seen Godzilla at that point. Mm-hmm. About it. But even before then, I'd seen King Kong starting with the late in the film, but it was something that I saw all of a sudden, this gigantic gorilla, and I'm like, what is this? And it must have been 5 years old when I saw it or my grandmother's house. And of course, you know, she's not going to change the channel because I mean, she, I was her pride and joy, and she wouldn't do that to me. So, but over the years, of course, I saw Seventh Voyage of Sinbad on TV when I was a kid. I saw, of course, Frankenstein, and then I did see Godzilla, so I started getting interested in this stuff. But I'll tell you, the one film, everybody has their tipping point, and for me, it was Equinox.
Equinox. Oh, good choice. Oh, cool movie.
Yeah, it was a film that I saw in its first release when it came out in Los Angeles. And, well, it was March 31st of 1971 when the film came out in L.A. And so we're coming up. We just passed, you know, it's been over 50 years now since the film was released, actually. I saw Dave Allen and Dennis Muren on TV that morning promoting the film. Dave had brought Taurus, and I think Dennis had the demon, the red demon model with him, and they're promoting the film, and I said, you know, one day I'm gonna make one myself. And
amazing. Awesome. There he is.
Got a little stop motion ball and socket model. This actually goes with the later on Dave gave me the book, the only surviving book from the film. So but I had found out that Equinox was shot around my neighborhood. In areas that I was hanging out when I was a kid. And I found out, even more importantly, a lot of the guys that made it, Dave, Dennis, Jim Danforth, Mark McGee, they all lived in my area. And I look in the phone book, it was actually Forrey Ackerman who introduced me to Jim Danforth. And then from there, you know, it just kind of snowballed, and I started bugging these guys weekly and going over and visiting them kind of just absorbing all this stuff. I mean, even before then, though, my neighborhood was where I grew up in Glendale. I grew up earlier in La Crescenta, where some of the Equinox was shot. Mm-hmm. In Glendale, I found all my neighbors were actors and editors and directors and stuff like that. One of my neighbors was a guy named Frank J. Urioste, who had edited RoboCop and Basic Instinct. I think maybe Total Recall also.
Oh, wow. So he's a Verhoeven guy, huh?
Yeah. And he, but he lived in my neighborhood when I was a kid. And I think he even still lives over in the same place. I think he's still around. Yeah, he told me, I know this might be my first like film encounter. He told me, he goes, in the 1960s, I worked in the editing department at Universal. One of the films I worked on was King Kong versus Godzilla.
Oh, wow.
That blew me away. I mean, I must have been maybe 13 or, you know, something like that. And to hear that is like, you know, I knew that film, so you know, just to know somebody. And then a few years later, some people moved in about three houses down from us, and it was Richard Chu, who was one of the editors of Star Wars, and his family. We got to be really good friends with them, and I used to get to, you know, carry his Oscar around, and he's house all the time when I was, you know, so it's like. So yeah, I mean, the area I grew up in was full of movie people. It turns out, I mean, Glendale's a movie hub.
Oh yeah.
And anyway, so I wasn't even aware of most of that though as a kid. It just kind of flew over my head, and it was just how I lived. But you know, over the years, I started getting a little more serious about it, and that's when I started to, you know, kind of get involved in things.
I mean, that's pretty incredible that you have those resources like right there when you're younger. A lot of people are, you know, making their own like little Super 8 movies and things like that, but you're actually getting to like interact with actual working Hollywood professionals, like from a very young age. That's really cool.
I have a little weird story. This is a little bit of an off track from Charlie Band, but
no, please.
I have a credit on Ed Hunt's final movie, Halloween Hell. I did some designs for it and they put a credit up for me, even though they didn't pay me. I didn't even tell me they're going to use one of the designs, but so there's my name on his film. But I finally, after decades, I mean, it's just like earlier this year, I watched a movie he did called Bloody Birthday.
Oh, yeah.
I love Bloody Birthday.
You know something? I always thought it was shot in Canada. I had no idea it was shot a block down from my house.
Oh, wow.
Neighborhood is where I grew up, on Idlewood Road, and the kids run up the street and they make a right turn on, or maybe a left turn onto Cumberland. And I'm like, oh my God, that's my old neighborhood. And I realized that I had met Ed and the producer when they stopped by our house. They were looking for places to shoot. And they talked to my dad, and after they left, my dad said there was something about, and we always thought it was like a commercial shoot or something, but it was like there was going to be like a fort built in our backyard for it. And it was Watch Bloody Birthday. And I see this little girl's got a fort in her backyard. And I go, my God, this is Idlewood Road. And I went, it finally hit me. And I'm like, our house was almost used in, in a Bloody Birthday. So that's like, it was weird. It's like the childhood I had.
Yeah.
More interesting the adult life that I lead.
You might want to look, Jeff, your neighborhood might also be used then in the opening scenes of a slasher movie from the same time called X-Ray or Hospital Massacre. You might know it as they shot that, I think, at the same time with the same kids from Bloody Birthday in the cast. And it's so weird because I put Hospital Massacre on, as one does, like a few months ago, and I thought to be messed up and put Bloody Birthday on because it's the same kids in the same neighborhood, basically the same house, it looks like. And I'm like, wait a second. And then sure enough, I went into an IMDb trivia rabbit hole about how they cast the same kids to play kids in this movie, which was very bizarre.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know that actually in our around our area, some of Neon Maniacs was shot also.
Very cool.
Very insufferably proud of all that stuff. I mean, we grew up in a place called Brand Park that every episode that I see of Mission Impossible that has it.
Yeah. See, I don't really get that living in Austin. Unless I'm watching like a Richard Linklater or a Robert Rodriguez movie, occasionally I'll get a little slice of Austin, but not often.
And a Terror last night. So.
Oh yeah, Planetary. Yeah, Planetary rules. They're about to give Rodriguez a little star out in front of our local theater, which is pretty cool.
This is totally off topic, but totally it's related to Robert Rodriguez. My wife, who's a few years younger than I am, got me to watch the movie Spy Kids for the very first time in my life the other day.
Yeah,
which I always knew Robert Rodriguez made it, but being admittedly a few years too old for it when it came out, it flew under my radar. But you know what?
Kind of fun.
It's a fun little movie. Yeah. Speaking of movies that I think are super fun. Now, I know one of if I'm wrong in this information, Jeff, let me know. But you were essentially first in terms of your relationship with Charlie. Now, you could talk a little bit about how that relationship started. But the first project you were initially brought in to work on, and then that kind of fell through, was Cellar Dweller. Was that correct?
Well, you know, actually, I had been interviewing at John Buechler's shop, like every guy, you know, who read Fangoria and even before that, Famous Monsters. And because John, I even remember John in the old Cinemagic magazines. So I knew who John was, and I knew I'd managed to, again, through the phone book, find out, you know, where he lived or actually where his shop was. But it wasn't really until I had a friend named Mike Moore that I went to school with, and even there's an even more interesting story that goes along with Mike and myself at Universal Studios, but we can talk about that later. Mike had gotten a job over at John Buechler's on Reanimator. And I was like, oh my God, really? It's like, and I couldn't get a job over there. I was like, oh, so jealous. I was like, just like, you know, my God. Yeah. And then I had another friend, a guy who I roomed, you know, was a housemate with, named Dirk Von Besser, who had worked at Filmation on, He-Man and stuff, and he got hired on to House with James Cummings's crew, and I was like, it's like I'm not getting hired on any of this stuff. And at that point, I'd already worked on Kingdom of the Spiders, and I worked on Vito's directorial debut, the ratings game, and things like that. But I had been interviewing at John Beekler's just like everybody else who, worked in the industry, because at some point or another, with so many shops around town, you kind of would just go from one place to another. And I got a call. I was actually living in a house, in a duplex right behind James Cummings in North. He had him and his partner had like a house in North Hollywood, and there was a duplex behind, and me and a friend moved in to this duplex that was behind their place. And so we used to hang out all the time. But I got a phone call one day. It's just like, in this John Beekler. And I'm like, he says, hey, we got Cellar Dweller going, and I want to bring you in on the crew, and we'll start like maybe tomorrow or something. I was like, awesome. I was so excited. I was thinking, great, get a chance to do this. And maybe a few hours later, I got a call from John again saying, well, budget got slashed. I can't bring an extra crew. That's there went my my big dreams and stuff like that. But it didn't take long before I ended up going over to Makeup Effects Labs. And one reason why I wasn't really working with James at that point is because he was bidding on jobs like Hell Comes to Frogtown and and they weren't really coming through either. And he was also focusing on his directing career at that point. So, and even though we would eventually do little things like Slumber Party Massacre 2 and Speak of the Devil and things like that.
Do not refer to Slumber Party Massacre 2 as a little thing. Okay. That is one of my very favorite movies of all time.
That was the first of many films I did with Tom Calloway. But I ended up over at Makeup Effects Labs for a few weeks. And then that led to going right over to Lance Anderson's on Serpent of the Rainbow. And that was about 3 months over at Lance's. And by the time I finished at Lance's, John suddenly needed more people. And I had gone over there and they said, hey, come by in about a week, start in a week. And I went, great. So a week later, I was on the Garbage Pail Kids movie. In prison. Also, that was my first Empire film, which is a very high point, luckily.
We just covered Prison on the show not long ago. We were both kind of blown away by it. That's one of those movies that's kind of hard to find now, but so worth tracking down. And the effects in that are so gross and so inventive and just fantastic.
Yeah, we had it set up and I was kind of worried I wasn't going to be able to find a copy of the movie in time. And then Nighthawk Cinema by me, which is kind of like an Alamo Drafthouse style movie theater, just out of the complete blue, 2 days before our recording was scheduled, was showing it as a screening. So I went and I got to see it on the big screen, which was really like an amazing way to see it. I mean, the effects in that whole, like the whole sequence with the barbed wire, got like a Rube Goldberg machine of barbed wire that goes no way you could possibly expect it to, just played so well on that presentation.
Yeah. Well, Mike Deke is certainly responsible for a lot of that stuff that went on set, him and Billy Butler and John Criswell. I think Greg Johnson also would go out on set also for it. Scott Wheeler also. And between those guys, I mean, really, like some really great work. People who really knew how to handle the stuff. And John went out there also for a time. And so, they really had a chance to really concentrate on doing some great gags, which was par for the course at the time, because that's really what there was sort of a focus on that thing. And also doing inventive like insert shots of things, trying to get it all in one shot, the more interesting way to do it. future filmmakers is to actually break it up into sections and edit. And I mean, the editing is the most important part also, and know how to light it, know how to frame it, and know how to, you know, really, I mean, if you need to do a reverse shot as opposed to trying to figure out how to do it, you know, another way. But that was the cool thing. But even more than that, it had a great script. I mean, Courtney Joyner's script and Rennie Harlan. I mean, what an amazing American debut for him to have with to just such an amazing career.
You had young Viggo Mortensen in there, and like amazing cast. Yeah, just a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it's just overall really, really, really outstanding. That was my first thing over there, and then, within about 3 weeks, I got John said, "Listen, we got Deadly Weapon going now, which was originally Laser Blast 2," and he says, "You're in charge." That was it. 2 weeks I was running a show at MMI with practically, I mean, just the only experience that I had was just of what I had gotten up to that point, but suddenly here I am, but because of the support from everybody at the shop and John also, because John and I would go out to set from time to time also, I do things like, I was the one who take the cigarette smoke and blow it through the tubes for the, you know, some of the gags and end up with a splitting headache.
Yeah.
Smoker. but still, it was a great learning experience. Worked with a lot of really great people and met a lot of really cool people too. And knowing that one time was Laser Blast 2, really cool feeling also, because I mean, having Laser Blast being one of my first Charlie Band experiences, you know, it's kind of full circle moments. And yeah. So you're sort of, you know, in that moment yourself. So, and not only that, we shot all around the area, so it wasn't no very far drives either. And it was fun hanging out with John all night and listening to stories and having him get wacky at times, you know, he'd get so tired that he'd just say something that would just everybody crack up. And it was such a good feeling. So, but yeah, you know, I mean, what, you know, working on the shows at that time was just such an amazing feeling because all so new.
Yeah.
You know, I'd already been sort of doing things for about 10 years by that point, but still at that point, I kind of felt that I was starting all over again.
Well, you were kind of working at Empire sort of around the time that the company was on the brink of sort of shutting down, but you also got to be involved in some of the sort of higher end projects from their late stage, you know, so we've got like Robot Jocks and Arena and things like that, which are really impressive special effects showcases. Like, so did you feel kind of the big difference in like budgets from starting from like Prison and then going on to Arena, or did you feel like a big difference in the production, or was it the same kind of energy?
You know, that energy flowed all the way up to the end, it seemed like, because, and maybe I didn't notice it because I was new, and it was also new to me that I didn't really have to be, I didn't even really have to worry about it. But we all did our jobs and we all took them on enthusiastically, and we all worked like, I mean, it seemed like we worked 90 minutes an hour, and we, you know, 26 hours a day and 12 days a week. But we had a great time. It was a lot of fun and the people were amazing. I mean, all the crew, I mean, everybody there. I mean, I never thought that I'd ever be working with guys like Scott Coulter and things. Scott's still like a really good friend. And, you know, it's just all, like I said, it's all the people you meet along the way that make it really special. But situations can be, you know, that way also. But, you know, and I even ended up getting a credit on Cellar Dweller because we, during the Robot Jocks, and we had a couple of weeks in which we had to throw together extra things for insert shots for films like Spellcaster. And John Criswell and Greg Johnson went back over to Italy to do reshoots for Pulse Pounders for the Evil Clergyman episode, because all of those shots with David Gale are all reshoots. I was involved in helping John life cast David for that. John did the blocked out the sculpture and then handed it over to me and said, here, you finish it and mold it. And
well, you had to get David Gale's head back on, first of all. I mean, that was the first step, right?
Really good job with that, because I mean, he, when he showed up, he was all in one piece. What a nice man he was. I mean, I'm so grateful to have met him, and he's so pleasant. And it wasn't until years later I met David Warner, but that was one of the early things I remember seeing when I first started there. John sculpting on a head cast of David Warner, and you know, for that particular episode. But it was later that we you know, a few months in, that we ended up doing, you know, all those insert shots for those shows. And so even by proxy, I get, you know, they slip my name into the credits, you know, because I spent like a week or so working on things, or I'd go in and also be like a close-up zombie in the Spellcaster shoot.
Oh, nice.
They put me in one of the zombie makeups and got some nice gory close-ups, you know, so that, you know, things like that. I mean, lots and lots of fun.
I mean, so you kind of segued from these Empire movies into, you had a string of working on some of the most iconic, like, special effects movies of this era. So I'm talking like the Blob remake from 1989, Alien 3, Death Becomes Her. You were kind of working on a lot of these really major movies that are remembered for their incredible special effects. Did you feel like a big shift where you're going from like Empire to like Universal? Was it a different kind of environment?
They were all sort of the same in a lot of ways, because even Empire took themselves seriously enough to run it like the business it should be run like. It was, you know, it was a film company, and they ran it like a film company, and everything being on film at the time meant that, you know, there were certain standards you had to live up to, especially if you were to get into a theatrical release, which was becoming difficult at the time. You know, and into the late 80s and into the 90s, a lot of those films really held sort of the same standards. It always felt like you had a trailer to work in, and you had a, you know, you weren't working in a bathroom or a closet or a basement or an attic or something.
Yeah.
And the actors seemed to really take their roles more seriously, and maybe not the greatest films, but there was a certain quality to them that were sort of followed over from the previous generation of filmmakers.
Yeah.
Same things, and hold the actors hold themselves. And, you know, going into those films, I mean, and it's funny too, this morning I was flipping the streaming channels. This is actually, as a matter of fact, they're running The Blob on one of the streaming channels, I noticed. And next month, while we're recording this, I'll be in East Stroudsburg co-hosting with Nick Benson, screening of The Blob and Demolition Man. But films like that, and Lionheart was on this morning too, and that was a show that another one because Death Warrant with Lance Anderson after I got back from Japan on a show called Tato Tyson or Doom Megalopolis. The Last Two, or Doom Megalopolis 2, The Last War, which is Media Blasters, just did the first US release of that. But it was funny. I mean, Lionheart, and suddenly it brought back so many memories of working on the show, especially the gag where a guy's hand gets stabbed, and they had to fly me out to Vegas to do this gag, and it all boiled down to, I just finished up on the show. They moved camp to location out in Vegas. And I thought my part's over, because the character that I was really working on isn't in those scenes. And I got a phone call from production, and they're saying, how we, Jean-Claude's come up with this idea that he wanted to. And they said, do you have a hand that could, like a fake hand or something like that? And I was like, oh my God, it's like, just like that, they need a fake handle. Wait a second. And I ran out into my backyard, because my shop was in my garage. I ran to my backyard, and about a year before, Scott Coulter, who was living at the same place, had cast a urethane arm, and he buried it in our backyard. And out there, and I dug this arm up, and it was actually still in good shape. It was dirty, but I cleaned it off, and I said, yeah, it's like, I got something here. And they flew me out to Vegas to see this gag for, it was like that. There would be like sort of these ongoing jobs that suddenly would pop up, and they wouldn't try to slam it all into principal photography. There would be a point where they might have to come in and call you in for insert shots, and it still happens. I mean, those things do happen still, but I'll tell you one thing, lately, not for me.
No. I'm sorry, I have to ask, why was the arm buried?
It's just something Scott did. He just like, kind of like what would happen. And I didn't even think about it. And it was suddenly, they need this hand. And I'm thinking, my God, it's like, at that point it was just, can you send out something that we can stab? You ship it out to us. And I went, yeah. And then within an hour, they called me back and said, listen, can we just fly you out here? We'll have a ticket for you, and we'll send somebody out to pick you up. And literally that night, I was flying out to Vegas for a few days to shoot this stuff. And any other little thing that would come up, like molding a prop or this or that. It was fun. It was a really exciting time. I worked on a lot of little shows like that too. I call them little shows, but they weren't really.
I was gonna say, like, the two Van Damme movies that you mentioned, like Death Warrant and Lionheart. I feel like in the early '90s, I must have saw those on cable a dozen times.
Oh yeah,
like every Van Damme movie from Bloodsport to Kickboxer to those two, everything up to Double Impact, I feel like played all the time.
You know what got me though is I realized that I think they ran Death Warrant yesterday or something like that. But it wasn't until later that I realized that Darren Serafian had starred in Zombie 3. And oh my God, I wish I'd known that. I would have bugged the hell out of him on set about working with Fulci and those guys, and seeing that was like, as having been over there when I was in Italy on Arena. We were shooting the old Dino De Laurentiis studio, and a lot of our crew were coming from places like Fulci Films. And as a matter of fact, the guy who plays the doctor in Arena towards the end of the film, David Thompson, I think his name or something like that. He went on, like, I think it's one of his next films, he played the killer in Cat in the Brain.
Direct Fulci connection there, yeah.
Or psychiatrist. And here's another little bit of trivia from Arena, is that during the casino scene, where I played the doorman, the doorman, who stole your heart sort of thing, but that sort of thing and stuff. We're in the alien mess that Andrew Canworthy made. But one of the waitresses in that scene was Paola Cozzi, who was in Demon.
But
the demon climbs out her back.
That's an iconic effect shot.
Me and Scott Coulter, even Scott Coulter is like an extra in that scene. You can't see him at all, but me and Steve Wang, and we're all standing there. None of us approached her. None of us. We were all just standing there, like, kind of like, oh my God, there she is. We can't believe it. But she's in the movie. You just don't see her.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was like, working with people who worked with Fulci, and our production manager Walter Massey is credited on Zombie and Contamination, and Victor Terjansky did The Black Cat with Fulci, and it was neat, really neat getting to work with those people.
My girlfriend will kill me as a huge fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer if I don't ask a little bit about your time on Buffy. You worked on there for the first two seasons, right? So were you responsible for kind of helping decide the look of the vampires for that show? Was that kind of part of your job?
Not really, because I came in, the first episode I worked on was the hyena episode.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Early episode shot, and the pilot was done by the Berman studio.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they, when they went into to series, they hired John Vulich and Optic Nerve Studios, and they had already shot, I think, the first episode, or maybe the first and second episodes. And I know that the Hyena episode was really early, and I just had gone back to work for Optic because I had done some work on Space Truckers earlier, but my work at my shop was slow, so I said, I got to find a job. I ended up going over to Optic Nerve for a couple of years, but yeah, Buffy was already going, and it was the Hyena, and then I think the next one after that was the Praying Mantis.
Oh yeah,
those are early. Yeah, those are early season one episodes. I remember those ones.
Yeah, but those are really early first season episodes. And I did go into the second season, and by that time I had started running Babylon 5.
Oh wow,
for John. But for the first two episodes of the second season, I ran those also, which was just a monumental job trying to run both shows.
Oh yeah, I bet.
And Barbarino came in and picked up, and he took over. And I mean, what can I say? The guy's amazing. The guy does such great work and tons of experience too. So, I'd go to set every once in a while. I remember going down and doing a 36-hour day, and then we went straight to set and did that demon from the ventriloquist dummy episode.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, going down and just, I mean, I managed to beg myself and to be able to get a shower on the way because my house was on the way to set, and I was listening. So luckily I was able to at least go down and be slightly fresh for
at least something.
Another 11 hours, not fun.
And so you were running everything on Babylon 5, is that right?
I was in charge of the shop, and then is on between the shop and the set work, and Jerry Gurgley was the supervisor on set, but I had to work with him also and make sure that a lot of that meant that I was like there at 4:30 in the morning dropping off prosthetics, and you know, the one getting the least amount of sleep for the most amount of work. But it was incredible. I mean, what a great time. And all the resources and the crew was amazing. I mean, everybody working there, we all again, it was one of those amazing experiences where we all got along really, really well. There were no real problems, no real drama, no nothing. It was really a good flow, and we had a great time doing that stuff. And it's too bad that John Vulich has passed away, but still, I mean, the opportunity to spend time working with him, and I mean, yeah, those were the golden moments.
You know? Yeah.
So I have to ask. Excuse me. I have to ask Jeff, while we have you here, I mean, obviously we love hearing about these stories involving, you know, a lot of genre stuff. You know, we've got Empire, Full Moon, Babylon 5, Buffy. I mean, very rooted in genre things. I'm very curious what your contribution was to get an uncredited credit as a makeup effects artist in the Oscar-winning movie As Good As It Gets.
Oh yeah,
I was curious about that. That one stood out. Yeah,
I mean, of course, I've got a copy of it somewhere, but it was on one of the streaming channels, and they just before the scene where Greg Kinnear was revealed in the hospital, and I had known Michelle Burke for a very long time. She was always very encouraging, and I'd interviewed with her a number of times, and there was even about a 45 minute, maybe 90 minute period in which I was going to run the David Lynch film Wild at Heart.
Oh wow.
He had taken the job, and then by the time I went over to her house to talk to her about it, she had decided to reject it because she was already on, I can't remember what she was already on a TV series at that point, and it was really more lucrative than taking on another film at that point. So she apologized to me and stuff, but she said she'd think of me for things in the future. It was a bit disappointing, but eventually she called me in to supervise a show that she was doing called The Color of Night.
Oh, the Bruce Willis movie. Yeah.
And Jane Jane March.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because she's asked me to come in and help her do a live cast of Who. I thought she said Jean Marsh.
Oh,
there's downstairs and stuff. And I go over there and there's Jane March standing there. And of course, you know, I'd never seen that movie, The Lover, but I'd heard about it. And I went, oh my goodness. It's like, she was really wonderful. But I was involved in that show with Michelle. And then when As Good As It Gets came up, she called me up. She said, I'm doing this show. I'd like for you to run it for me. Here's where we actually get a little bit of an Empire Films connection at that
point. Cool. See, okay. I didn't know that there would be one, but I like in hearing this now how this is all interconnected.
And you're going to really like this one because comes the day that we've got to do Greg Kinnear's life cast. And he's a great guy and really a lot of fun to talk to. And he's really friendly and really easygoing. And the life cast went off without a hitch. But I don't remember who said it first, but somehow he let it slip that he was working in the office, in production office at Empire during Prison.
Mm.
Yeah, he was working there.
Charles Band mentions that in his autobiography. Yeah, he was like a PA. Yeah.
Greg was there, but that's when I first heard about that Greg had, you know, Greg, and I worked on Prison. I was over there at that time. So it was really cool. It was like a neat, you know, neat story to hear. Part of the cool part about that job was I got to do some of it at home. I just, you know, she said we got the live cast and I started doing some of the sculpture work. And then she's, so here you guys just take it home. Me and a guy named Tom Irvin, who was and Chris Bergschneider came in and ran all the gelatin for the pieces. And that job actually, Ed French got hired to go into Michelle to apply the pieces. And afterwards, Ed called me up and said, I liked your pieces. I want to hire you. And that led to about 10 years of working like almost exclusively with Ed French, doing a lot of his lab work, sculpture and lab work and stuff like that. So, you know, and heard a couple of stories about his days working back east on the Tim Kincaid and, you know, shows and, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, heard that story about the cinematographer who forgot to load the camera on an insert day they weren't supposed to be working and got half the day without filming the camera.
Oh no.
it's in the Empire book.
Oh my God, that'd be such a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So it's around this time that you're also kind of getting back into the full moon orbit a little bit more. And again, I'm basing this off your IMDb, which, as we all know, is rock solid, completely 100% accurate to everybody's career every time. But
pretty good. I mean,
yours is pretty good.
You can get a little freedom to do that just in case you just want to, you know,
So you're working on movies like Killer Eye and one of our personal favorites on this show, Blood Dolls, which we think is just a really wild and funny and inventive movie that we had a lot of fun on. So did you get to work like on some of the little tiny terrors?
I did, but you know, I'm gonna lead that up to I had done some work over. I started working for Full Moon a bit earlier because I had worked over at John Beekler's on Demonic Toys. I sculpted the full size bear creature.
Oh, cool.
Mike Deke is in the suit. I sculpted and molded that head for John. So I went in for a few days and I don't think I have a credit on it, but still that was one thing I did. And then Alchemy Effects hired me for Mandroid to go and make some molds for them. And then I had gone over to Romania and done the Primevals with them in 94 with Dave Allen and, you know, Chris Endicott. So I ran that show for them over in Romania for the pieces that Steve Neal and Mark Rappaport's units had done. So that was, you know, so I'd already been working for Full Moon up to a certain point, but when it came down to us getting Chris Bergschneider and I getting hired on the Killer Eye, Chris had been doing a lot of work for Mark Rappaport at that point.
Okay.
And he had gone over and done the Duck World shows and stuff like that. So he was known around the Full Moon offices at that point. And this is when Mark Williams was also doing a lot of stuff. And Mark had been put in charge of Full Moon's effects unit, essentially. And unfortunately, he was also very ill with cancer. And he had passed away. This was just prior to the Killer Eye. And he had already been building that. And he had built all of the Blood Dolls puppets. He had already had all sort of built. They were all very crudely built. He didn't get very much money to build them, but they were all, you know, really very crudely built. But he passed away, and that left them with a void. And Chris got the call from Charlie asking if he could step in. And because I had a shop, I had a little shop in my garage, Chris, you know, Chris and I had been working together for so many years. We just ended up teaming up and doing the Killer Eye, doing a four shoot on the Killer Eye. And, where I learned Dave Dakota's stellar, you know, his amazing way of shooting a 4-day film. You're in a room with four. He points at one wall, says day one, points at the second wall, two, third wall, three, fourth wall, day four. Done.
Great.
I don't think I've ever in my life encountered someone in any field in the world who is as prolific as Dave Dakota is.
Yeah.
Like, we can't go an episode of this show, it seems, without somehow bringing up something he was involved in.
Yeah, he's definitely like one of the names that comes up the most on this show. Yeah,
so many years before I started working for him, and I even, again, he's another name I remember back from Cinemagic.
Yeah,
but he put, you know, had promoted in there, but it was the final day that we had shot our wrap day on the Killer Eye, that Dave comes up to and says, "You guys are, Charlie's so happy with you guys, and I'm so happy with you that you guys are doing the next Puppet Master."
Oh, amazing. And that's retro, right? You get to work on retro. Yeah.
It's only a few months away. I mean, it wasn't immediate, but we had already been handed that job. And as that was starting up, they were also going to shoot Witch House.
Oh, yeah.
Prior, but Witch House, it was weird because Witch House was originally slated to shoot in Los Angeles while Retro was going to shoot in Romania. And we did a production meeting with the full crew here in LA for the film. And it wasn't until we were already in pre-production on both shows that Chris, he's on the phone with Charlie, and then he says, "Jeff," and I went, "Wait a second, I'm going to Romania, aren't I?" And he says, "Yeah, it's like they're shooting Witch House over in Romania now." And so I ended up flying over on that, and I wasn't even supposed to stay for Retro Puppet Master. I ended up, they figured since I was there, they might as well just keep me there. And I left a few days early from the shoot, but still, it was an amazing experience. Wow, you know, it was just, you know, I look back on how crude everything was. I'm like, oh, my makeups are just so terrible too. They're just so, so bad. But Dave loved them. I mean, it's like, I think Charlie liked them too. It's like, they're like overly theatrical and heavily too, leaning too much in purple.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, still, yeah. But and those mummies, or the Stephen Blackheart and his cohorts in Retro, are all just leftover makeup from Witch House. I just, I don't know. And not only that, I look at them now and I go, a couple of photos look okay. A few shots in the film look okay, but they go in for some clothes. I'm like, oh my god, why didn't I just? a coat over them to tone them down or a little bit. It's just, but we were just moving so fast on those shows.
Oh yeah.
Right. Hindsight is 2020, and it's like, if nothing else, you can kind of look back on some of those things and look at them as a product of their time and a product of the budget and the timing allotted to you to make the movie. And I think there's sort of, there's a sense of charm, I think. So obviously, like anything else, you look back on some of your creations and you cringe, you look back on other creations and you feel a sense of pride. Like in your body of work, what is the piece, single sort of effect or prosthetic or whatever that brings you the most pride?
Yeah, I will tell you, in the Charlie Band world, the one that does, it's great that you brought this up, is because it was Evil Bong 2.
Really? Amazing.
I mean, I had already done Evil Bong sort of almost under protest. I had one idea.
We basically watched it under protest.
More than one bong for the first movie. There are different stages of it, and each one of those is a different thing. But my idea is I wanted to do it so it was about a silicone and flexible, so I could do things like make the stem bend and do things do some things and maybe have some bladders in it to give it maybe some breathing and stuff. And then so there's fiberglass with a silicone face glued on that to this day is still there. It's the original face, and I'm surprised that it's still there and working. But Evil Bong 2 has that overweight makeup on Brian Lloyd, that obese makeup on him. And suit an obesity suit on him, and that was something Charlie, it was in the script, and I knew that Brian wasn't overweight, and I went, this is gonna be a makeup, this is gonna be a prosthetic, and I'd already done a number of them for Ed French. I already sculpted a number of prosthetics for various shows for Ed, and as well as I did Jack Black's piece for Tropic Thunder for Marshall. I sculpted piece and then it was, I sculpted and molded, and then it was run over at Spectral Motion by Roland Moore. And it was an amazing experience. I mean, Charlie up to that point in his career had never had that sort of makeup. I mean, I think the closest I might have gotten to sort of like a realistic character type makeup may have been in Mansion of the Doomed with those eyeless characters that Stan Winston did, but those really lean more into a horror angle. You know, that, that Lance Henriksen's eyes trying to blink, it's obviously a puppet. It's amazing. I only finally saw that film just a few months ago, also. And I just thought, wow, that was a really great scene. And, but to be able to do that was a gift. I mean, it really was like, I mean, Charlie trusting me to be able to do this piece. And I even built that suit practically by myself. Robert Miller and Dirk von Besser helped me out for maybe a day. Robert brought me some adhesive and Dirk came up for a few hours and helped me glue some foam and stuff down. But I built that suit by myself virtually in about 2 days. I just told the wardrobe department, make sure his arms are totally covered and make sure that, you know, it's a certain size and this and that, but it turned out pretty darn good. I mean, I was surprised how well it turned out for being done so quickly and how nice it looked for being so low budget. And
I feel like that's the praise we give to a lot of these Empire and full moon movies that end up being pretty good. Like it's been a common thing to say, like, we're surprised how good this movie looks. Like, given the fact that what they shot this movie in a week and all of the moving parts that had to come together for it to be even, you know, completed, which is we recognize now is like crazy under the conditions for some of the stuff to even get completed. So it's like not surprising to me that you'd have that.
So critical. Reaction. Makeup like that, because it has to look real and it can't look too fake, and you know, it really can't look fake. And I had a guy named David Patrick who came in. He ran the set for me when I wasn't around, and we established that makeup together, and he took over on it and did it for the rest of the show. But it was just one of those things that came together. I think the closest I got after that was on Ginger Dead Man 3, the character who, the aunt or whatever, the lead character, the one who runs the roller rink, she, it was a guy in drag, but they had most of the film was in an old age makeup, wearing some generic prosthetics that I had made that just for the heck of it. And I said, no, stick them on. And they ended up looking really good with the wig and the makeup by Lolly Pierre. It looked pretty, outstanding considering we did it for nothing. It was really cool. Cause again, Charlie just doesn't do that sort of level in most of his films. It's always some really wild character or creature or, something like that, but never really a realistic. So I feel very proud of those. I mean, I would also then third, I would say that Stan Lee Lightspeed show I did the Python creature for Sci-Fi Channel. Another high point. An okay budget, not a great amount of time, but we pulled everything off and
ended up looking nice.
I mean, we've still got Ginger Dead Man 3 and Evil Bong 2 still to watch on our show. We haven't got to those yet, so we're excited to keep that in mind now that we're going to be getting into those. Now, I don't want to keep you too much longer because you've been so generous with your time, and we could probably bug you about this all day, but I did really want to ask about probably the movie we're most excited about to see this year is The Primevals. Which is finally, so you mentioned that you were working on this in 1994. How does it feel knowing that this movie is finally getting completed and shown and released 30 years later?
It has been 30 years since we shot it, but my time actually goes back further.
Oh, wow.
It goes much further with The Primevals. Not that I worked on it, but in 1978 was when I first met David Allen at his original studio over in Burbank, which was next door to the NBC studios in Burbank. Mm-hmm. That building is now no longer there. It's been redeveloped and new buildings are there, but Dave had a place in sort of a two-story like playhouse, I guess. And I got invited over one night and about 1978, and there was the fully built arena set on the stage, the old playhouse stage in that place, as well as I have some very terrible instamatic photos of the mind control gun, which was already built at that point. I saw numerous, lizard men models, and I have a different angled photo of that creature, that mammal that David Carson is pictured sculpting in the Cine Fantastique article, which came out a few months later, as I recall.
Is this that kind of red ape looking creature?
Our Cinetherium sort of looking thing on all fours. It replaced the ground sloth that was going to, and it was just going to be some beast of burden in a shot. Nothing really that, it was just there for effect or for atmosphere, but it was going to be some extra stop motion for the film. And I saw all that stuff and I heard a bit about it. That was the night that Dave Allen gave me that book from Equinox. Also, like, I own the only surviving book from Equinox, thanks to Dave.
And that's amazing.
It was like in 94, I had heard that Primevals was in production and they were doing it at Full Moon my roommate at the time, or housemate, David Matherly, who had worked on Fright Night and Poltergeist 2 and stuff like that, he had been working at Steve Neal's on the hominid suits. So I knew it was going on. And Dave was slated to go over to Romania with the show. And the reason he didn't is because he had also decided he was going to go to work for Todd Masters, who was gearing up on the Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight movie.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, Todd would have hired me I'll tell you as a little side note is he said he was hiring anybody whose name was Scott. He had Scott Coulter, Scott Wheeler, Scott. I mean, he had all these guys named Scott, and because my middle name is Scott, he would have hired me. As a matter of fact, I think he called me. I said, I think at that point I was already committed to the Primevals. And I was also working on the Godzilla. I did Sony Imageworks piece for or Godzilla sculpture for the 94 Godzilla. And then I did some Trendmasters toys also. But this is all happening around the same time. And Dave decided to go to work on Demon Knight because part of the reason is because the airport hangar where they were shooting the film, I was about a mile away from where we lived.
Perfect.
You can work all night, you drive a mile and you're at home. You know, you're not like, you know, it's not an all, you know, so he recommended me and I went down to Full Moon and I told him the whole story about me going to Dave's and this, and I'd known Dave since the 70s anyways, and Dave wasn't opposed. I was also up for Puppet Master 2 for doing the makeup for that. I did a bit on that, and it was Dave Barton who got it and of course did an amazing job on it. So, but I ended up getting the Primeval's job. And then about 10 days after, I was flying to Romania for a 9-week stint. And not only, you know, doing those things that Mark Rappaport's units, like the big Yeti stuff, and the they built a full scale hominid hand for a shot, which I repainted, and little things that, you know, that they did, and Steve Neal all the hominid suits. And I had a couple of weeks when I got to Romania just sitting around while the crew was in Italy shooting in the mountains. And so I sat and refurbished all the suits. I just had nothing else to do. I sat in my my hotel room drinking beer and drinking Romanian beer and fixing suits while the TV was on and running. It was weird. The TV ran the Flintstones movie, which was in the theaters in the U.S. at the time.
They had weird
bootleg movies on the TV at the hotel. I saw the Flintstones. I saw a couple of old when PM Entertainment was City Lights, and they ran. It was like, I think I ran the Newly Deads or one of the early shows. It was so weird watching it on, you know, TV over there. Just, you know, all of a sudden, the TV would go wacky, and suddenly some movie would come on, and you'd know that it was a bootleg.
That's great.
And I ended up playing a lot of the hominid roles too.
Kidding.
Kevin Mangold, who is the new Slimer in the new Ghostbusters, he was one of the main hominid actors. And then a guy named Billy Scudder, who was for Xerox or IBM, I can't remember. They had Charlie Chaplin as their sort of spokesperson. It was Billy Scudder who did all these ads and commercials and stuff, playing Charlie Chaplin, and made the guy a ton of money and, you know, famous and stuff like that. But he was playing the other one. And then they had some local dancers for the wide scenes where they needed a lot of them. And then any other little, you know, like a dead hominid or hominid, like popping up and running out of the scene or something like that, or even in the arena was me in the scene. And I was surprised to see, I mean, I've seen the film. Seen the completed film at the Alamo Draft House when it premiered here in LA. Kevin Mangold and Chris Endicott and I were all there, you know, and it was so weird because those shots popped up and all of a sudden it was, oh my God, I remember that. There I am lying in Bat Guano in that cave in the Carpathian Mountains where I was like just getting claustrophobia.
Yeah.
Like in that suit, and then Juliet Mills looking down at me and smiling, and I grew up watching her and Nanny and the Professor, and I just everything. Oh, it was just great. She was wonderful. I mean, just an amazing, experience working with her. And I've seen the film, and it's so amazing because it is very old fashioned in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I mean, to have worked on a film that had that much stop motion in it, and to I always wanted to work on a Ray Harryhausen film, and or I always wanted to do something like that. And then also to find myself in the film interacting with stop motion, characters, or, it's sort of like that bucket list thing,
It's like, got to be such a cool, like, full circle moment as a kid who loved Harryhausen and Equinox, and then you get to see this movie kind of come to fruition. And also just so cool. We've come to really love and appreciate the work of Dave Allen over the course of doing this show, and just Absolutely. What a master he was. So it was a real loss to lose him as early as we did. So it's going to be so cool that, like, a new audience is going to get a chance to discover this. And we can't wait. It hasn't come to the Alamo in either of our markets yet. We're hoping it does soon, but I know there's a Blu-ray coming out in a couple months soon. So,
yeah, yeah. Forward to that. I'm waiting to hear whether there's something contributing to that Blu-ray, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But regardless, to be honest, I've got like a bunch of footage that I shot somewhere, then I think I found it, but there's a blank tape, there's a bunch of blank tapes, and it's got to be on those, and it's like, and maybe one day it'll see the light of day. But regardless, I'm really interested in seeing this, multi-disc set and seeing everything that goes with it, and just to reminisce, to be a fan also. I wanted to work on the show before I got in the industry, and I found myself on it, and I was very, very lucky to be there.
That's so cool.
I would agree with that. Yeah. No, Jeff, this has been amazing. I'm glad we kind of found our way to Primeval's kind of at the end here to tie everything together. It really is amazing. It's like, I sort of, to me, the equivalent of that would be if, like, I somehow, 10 years from now, found myself as someone being killed by Robert Englund in a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. It's it would be, it's like, cross that off the bucket list. But thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about all this, about all these great, stories and your role in all these seminal Empire and Full Moon properties and movies. And I love the fact that, and you're not the only person who does this, who calls them shows.
Mm.
I love, we found every single person, I think, that we've talked to who's been involved in productions with Charlie Band has used the word show. And I always wondered, is this like a Charlie specific thing, or is this just a showbiz thing?
I think it's showbiz. It really is just a show. I'll point something out that a lot of people are critical about things. And even I'm critical about, especially about sort of the current films in some way. And honestly, I think that everybody who wants to make a film really should make a film, because you never will know where it'll lead you. Abrams started out with Don Doler, and look where he's at now. For me, it's sort of like when I'm watching a bad film and I see something that isn't so, like, realistic, and I don't get so bothered by those sorts of things anymore, because I kind of realize you're not expected to really believe any of what you're watching. It's like, you're there just to be entertained. I don't watch a movie to believe it. I don't think I ever did, because I knew it was a movie.
Yeah.
There's credits or people who worked on it. People put months of their lives into these things, and, sometimes years, there is a point where there has to be some belief in it. And that's the characters in the film. They're the only ones expected to really believe what they're saying. And I even think about, like, what was his name? The lead actor in The Giant Claw. He's, of course, they didn't see anything while they're shooting it. So he imagined something, and then he finally saw it with an audience. And he said he had to slink out of the audience before anybody recognized him.
Cause it looked, it's like a big chicken. Yeah. It looked very,
Well, regardless, I mean, there's something about that thing that I still love. And there's a lot of story behind the way that things, the reason why they are the way they are. It's easy to poke fun at, and it's easy to you know, make those assumptions, but there's always a story. Like Equinox has an entire story behind it that nobody really thinks about when they're reviewing it. I got about 43 pages written of just stuff that's like, when you put it all together, it's kind of an amazing, you know, story.
Yeah.
And we've approached our show that way, where I think looking at these movies and then talking a little bit about the production and stuff that we've read about and learned along the way, it makes us more forgiving, I think, watching the movies too, you know, that are flawed movies in certain ways. And some people approach to interact with that kind of media by, like you said, just kind of making fun of it, pointing out the flaws, this and that. And, you know, Steve and I have moved sort of away from that, I would say, in our model for what we want our show to be. And we love getting to have conversations like this with Jeff, with people like yourself and people involved in these projects. And we've really, you know, gotten a ton of reverence for a lot of the material.
Yeah.
And if you like what we do, then you can jump onto Apple Podcasts or Spotify and drop us a little 5-star rating or a brief review if you feel so inclined. If you want to learn more about the show, if this was your first time discovering it, you can follow us on social media on Instagram at puppetmasters_castlefreaks. You can follow me personally at _giallo_Jerry or Steve at @MinotaurMatador. There is another podcast that Steve has going on that he would like to plug. And then Jeff, if there's anything after Steve does his plug, if there's anything you want to tell our listeners about where they can find some of your work or anything that they should check out, please do. But Steve, where else can people find you?
Yes, my other podcast is called Cinemarcade. That's cinema and arcade is one word. We are watching movies and then playing the video games based on them to compare and contrast. And sometimes we get some pretty hilarious results, and sometimes we find some real gems, much like we do on this show. But yes, Jeff, do you have anything you'd like to plug or promote, or anywhere people can go to see your work?
You can see my work at let's see now, Instagram. I am Obscure Artifacts, all one word, lowercase. I'm Jeff Farley on Facebook, and I have an Obscure Artifacts page up there. And then there's my Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys fans page my fiance made. And
very cool.
But I have coming up, of course, The Primevals is going around and will be released on Blu-ray at some point in the next few months. I have also came out Space Wars, Quest for the Deep Star came out, I think, earlier this year. And that one's a lot of fun because that is a very, very, you know, Star Crash type of, you know, science fiction. Nice. A lot of fun. And I have coming up in September, Anchor Bay, the newly reformed Anchor Bay, is releasing theatrically Abruptio. And that is an all puppet horror psychodrama.
Oh,
nice.
Directed by Evan Marlowe and produced by his wife Carrie. And it stars James Marsters, Haname Lee, Sid Haig's final role.
Oh wow.
Christopher McDonald, cool. Jordan Peele, and Robert Englund all playing characters that are also puppets. They are not puppets of themselves, but these are some really weird characters. I made most of them. There are Alicia Berry made some. Mark Villalobos made the original puppet, but I did the majority of the work. I did maybe a baker's dozen or 15 or so of these things for the film. And it will be in theaters in September.
I will definitely be seeking that one out. So, Jeff, thank you so much again for taking the time to have this conversation with us. It was an absolute blast, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. And listeners, we will hopefully see you next week in our regularly scheduled episode of Puppet Masters Castle Freaks. Thank you so much for joining us today. See you next time.